All right, let's dive in. Today, we're tackling a Supreme Court case that really gets you thinking about what interrogation actually means when it comes to those Miranda rights. You know, the whole, you have the right to remain silent bit.
Yeah, it's a real head-scratcher, this case. It goes right to the heart of that balance between protecting individual rights and giving law enforcement what they need to do their job.
We're talking about Rhode Island v. Innis. This case added a whole new layer of complexity to Miranda. To set the scene, it's 1975 in Providence, Rhode Island. A cab driver's been murdered.
Tragic start.
Absolutely. Police arrest a man named Thomas Innis for robbing another cab driver, this time at gunpoint. They read him his Miranda rights, and he asks for a lawyer. Pretty standard so far, right?
Seems like it.
And here's where it gets interesting. As officers are driving Innis to the station, they start talking amongst themselves about the shotgun from the murder, the one that's still missing.
Oh, so a little casual chatter, but maybe with a purpose.
Exactly. One officer mentions a nearby school for kids with disabilities and says he's worried a kid might find the shotgun and hurt themselves. And that's when Innis suddenly tells them to turn the car around so he can show them where the gun is hidden.
Wow, so he reacted to a conversation he wasn't even a part of directly.
The question the Supreme Court had to grapple with was, did that conversation between those officers count as interrogation, even though they never directly questioned Innis? I mean, he'd asked for a lawyer, so any questioning should have stopped, right?
Right. This case really forced the court to figure out where the boundaries of interrogation are, you know, looking at those fuzzy areas that go beyond just straight up questioning. And the majority opinion, written by Justice Stewart, it actually introduced this new concept called the functional equivalent of questioning.
Okay, now that sounds complicated. Can you break that down a bit?
Sure. So think of it this way. The court recognized that police can get incriminating information from a suspect in ways that are more subtle than just directly asking questions, right? It's not just about what they say, but what they should reasonably know could get a suspect talking.
So it's about what a reasonable officer would understand about their own words and actions in that moment.
Yes, exactly. So should these officers have known that their conversation about that missing shotgun, even if it seemed casual, was likely to make Innis incriminate himself? That's the question.
And to drive this point home, the majority opinion actually says, a practice that the police should know is reasonably likely to evoke an incriminating response from a suspect, thus amounts to interrogation.
That quote really nails it. It shifts the focus from what the police intended to the potential impact of their actions on the suspect.
Okay, so in this case, the majority ruled that based on what the officers knew about Innis, that conversation wasn't actually considered interrogation. But you mentioned earlier we have four other opinions from the justices, and not everyone agreed.
Right. Those dissenting opinions really reveal how deep this debate goes and the different ways people saw this issue.
For instance, Justice Marshall, he argued, are we really supposed to believe that officers talking about a missing shotgun and the danger to children wouldn't get a response from any suspect? He saw it as a clear appeal to Innis's conscience, especially with the potential for a kid finding that weapon.
Justice Marshall was very aware of the power imbalance, you know, in a police interrogation and how easily suspects can be manipulated, even without direct questioning.
Then we have Justice Stevens, who had another perspective. He said the focus should be on how the suspect perceives the situation, not just what the police should have known. It's basically if the police do or say anything that a reasonable person in the suspect's position would see as a reason to respond, it should be considered interrogation.
Yeah. Justice Stevens was deeply concerned about protecting that right to remain silent, you know, the heart of it. He worried that by limiting what interrogation means, the court was opening the door for police to use psychological tricks and manipulation that might not be direct questioning, but could still be very coercive.
So two contrasting views there. The majority focusing on the perspective of a reasonable officer and Justice Stevens on the suspect's experience. It highlights that tension between protecting individual rights and giving law enforcement the tools they need.
Exactly. That's it. And the fact that the justices had such differing opinions just shows how incredibly complex this issue really is.
It really makes you think about how important those Miranda safeguards are, this whole case.
Oh, absolutely. They're not just some legal formality. You know, they're there to level the playing field in a situation that's inherently kind of skewed towards law enforcement.
Yeah, when someone's in custody, they could be scared, confused, under pressure. It's easy to see how even subtle cues from police could influence what they say or do.
Totally. It's a good reminder that we need to be really careful about protecting those fundamental rights. making sure that any confession is truly voluntary, not because of any kind of pressure, subtle or not.
And speaking of being thorough, we haven't even touched on the two concurring opinions in this case. Justices White and Berger, they agreed with the majority that Innes wasn't actually interrogated, but they got there in different ways, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Those concurring opinions, they add another layer of nuance to an already super complex case. Justice White, he actually preferred the reasoning he had laid out in a previous case, Brewer v. Williams. That one also dealt with the right to counsel during interrogation.
So even though he agreed with the outcome in Innes, he wasn't totally on board with the idea of functional equivalent that the majority put forward.
It seems that way, yeah. His concurrence kind of suggests a little worry about this broader definition of interrogation. Like, he was concerned that it might weaken the protections that Miranda was meant to give.
Interesting. And what about Chief Justice Berger's concurrence? What was his take?
Well, Berger's concurrence brings up the practicality of it all, like how this decision would actually work in the real world. He worried that this new functional equivalent test was too subjective, too difficult for law enforcement to apply consistently. Like, it put too much of a burden on police officers, you know, trying to figure out a suspect's suggestibility in the middle of a tense situation.
That's a valid point. Imagine you're an officer in a high-pressure situation, and you have to assess someone's mental state, predict how they'll react to what you say. Sounds like a recipe for confusion.
That's exactly what Berger was worried about. He thought this decision would make an already complicated area of law even more confusing, making it harder for officers to do their jobs and for courts to make consistent rulings.
It feels like this case, even though it was about a specific conversation in a police car, it opened up all these questions about police tactics, individual rights, the limits of acceptable persuasion.
Absolutely. It's a reminder that the law isn't always black and white. Lots of gray areas. And figuring those out requires looking at the context, you know, the different interests at play and the potential consequences of our decisions.
Well said. So for our listeners who might not be legal experts, let's try to distill this down to a few key takeaways. What are the big aha moments from Rhode Island v. Innes?
Okay, here's what I'd say. First, this case really broadened the legal definition of interrogation under Miranda. It's not just about direct questions anymore. That functional equivalent concept means that even indirect or seemingly casual statements by police, they can be considered interrogation if they're likely to lead to a self-incriminating response.
So words matter, even when they're not a question.
Exactly. Second takeaway, the case emphasizes how important the suspect's state of mind is during interrogation. Even if the police don't think they're being coercive, their actions and words, they could still be perceived that way by a suspect who's feeling vulnerable or pressured or confused.
It's not just about the police's intent, but how their actions are seen by the person in custody.
Precisely. And finally, Rhode Island v. Innes. It highlights this constant struggle to find a balance between safeguarding individual rights and giving law enforcement the tools they need to solve crimes. Finding that balance, it's never easy, and this case just shows how complex those issues really are.
Welcome back to our deep dive on Rhode Island v. Innes. We've explored the whole interrogation thing and heard from the different justices, but now we come to a really crucial question. Did Thomas Innes, by leading the police to that murder weapon, did he actually waive his Miranda rights?
This is a great question. It really gets to the core of how these Miranda rights work in practice. You know, the idea is that suspects have to knowingly and voluntarily give up those rights. It's not just about being told about them.
Right. So in Innes' case, he did ask for a lawyer.
Ooh.
But the circumstances surrounding his decision to say where the shotgun was are,
well,
a little murky, to say the least.
Yeah, no kidding. So the trial court judge, he actually allowed the shotgun to be used as evidence. He decided that Innes had given a clear and intelligent waiver of his right to remain silent. But when the case went to the Rhode Island Supreme Court, they saw it differently. They overturned his conviction, arguing there wasn't enough proof of a valid waiver.
Ah, so another disagreement. And this time, it's not just about what interrogation means, but about what makes waiving those constitutional rights actually valid.
Exactly. What's so important here is this idea of voluntariness. For a waiver to be valid, it can't be the result of coercion or pressure, right? It has to be a real choice made by the suspect with them understanding the consequences.
But given everything that happened in Innes' case, the officer's conversation, his possible, you know, susceptibility to their worries about children, can we really say his choice was completely voluntary? That's where it gets tricky.
You got it. That's the heart of the matter. The dissenting justices, Marshall and Stevens especially, they'd argue that everything leading up to Innes's statement was tainted by that functional equivalent of interrogation we talked about before. They'd say the officer's conversation, whether they meant to or not, created a pressure-filled environment that affected Innes's ability to freely and knowingly waive his rights.
So they're basically saying that because Innes felt like he had to speak up, even after asking for his lawyer, that means the waiver wasn't truly voluntary.
Exactly. Their argument would be that the police, by having that conversation, kind of bypassed Innes's request for a lawyer.
Right.
And put him in a situation where he felt he had to cooperate.
That raises a bigger question then, one that goes beyond this case.
Mm-hmm.
How can we make sure those waivers of Miranda rights are truly knowing, intelligent, and voluntary? Especially when there might be these subtle forms of psychological pressure.
That's a huge question. And there's no easy answer, really. It's all about finding a balance. We want to protect individual rights and make sure confessions aren't coerced. But we also want law enforcement to be able to, you know, effectively do their job, investigate crimes.
So we need clear rules for how police should act, careful review by the courts of those waiver claims, and maybe even better training for law enforcement, so they really understand the nuances of interrogation and how important it is to respect that right to silence.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. This case and all the debate around it, it really serves as a reminder that protecting those constitutional rights, it takes constant work. We need clear legal standards and a commitment to fairness in our justice system.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Rhode Island v. Innes, it's pretty obvious that this case leaves us with more questions than answers. It really challenged us to think about those blurred lines of interrogation, the delicate nature of waivers, and that constant balancing act between individual rights and what law enforcement needs.
Definitely. It reminds us that legal precedents, even though they're essential, aren't always cut and dry, you know? They need interpretation, analysis, and often good debate.
And that debate is vital for making sure that justice and fairness prevail. So for everyone listening, as you navigate the world of legal issues, remember Rhode Island v. Innes. It's a case that encourages us to think critically, to question assumptions, and to be aware of those subtle but powerful forces that can shape how justice works.
And maybe the next time you hear those Miranda warnings, you'll listen a little more closely. You'll understand just how complex it all is, even though the words seem simple.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.